Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Alistair Benn, from the editorial team at Reaction. Here at Reaction, over the last couple of weeks, really, we've been writing a lot about Emmanuel Macron. He seems to have a rare gift for turning the banality of foreign policy into sort of incredible media spectacles. And so I thought I'd make a kind of special podcast featuring an interview with one of our leading academics and one of our leading thinkers on French culture and French history. I went to meet Jeremy Jennings, head of the Department of Political Economy at King's College London and professor of political theory. His first book was on the French thinker Georges Sorel, and since then Jeremy has written widely on the role of intellectuals in French public life. He's currently working on a book entitled Travels with Tocqueville, and I wanted to kind of introduce my discussion with Jeremy with a quick reflection of my own. In de Gaulle's memoirs is a very famous section where he talks about the liberation of France as, quote-unquote, a miracle of national conscience. And this has kind of stayed with me. And it's the same sort of place where he evokes a certain idea of France, a certain vision of French nationhood, which I think is very powerful and also very interesting for two reasons. It's also a completely ecstatic vision he gives us in his memoirs of a united France, a place where the nation is just one thought, is this ecstatic union, a coming together of all the kind of divided constituencies that make up the French, kind of the pattern of French life. And it's this sort of binding language that I've always thought was quite interesting in French affairs. Each new president feels they have to restate it. After every election, they use the same language. France is one, not two, not many, it is one. But this to me has always seemed much truer in seeming than in reality. Take de Gaulle as an example. In 1945, the time he's writing about, France is so divided, divided in ways that I think in Britain we've had the luck to avoid. We were never invaded, we never had to make those choices. So in France you have the choices between resistance and collaboration, and these choices for individuals also fell along kind of historic divides between parts of France that had never really embraced the, again my English pronunciation getting better than me, embraced a national republican vision, and those who never really did in Brittany, in Alsace, or even in the Basque Country. So there's always these kind of deep linguistic, social, and cultural divisions that create France. But de Gaulle is interested in the one France, the France of harmony, cooperation, and unity. And Emmanuel Macron, I think, is a new iteration of this old impulse. His monograph, which he published before he ran for president, is called Révolution Réconcilier la France, which translates roughly as Bring France Back Together. So Jeremy had some really interesting reflections on precisely this topic, and we began our discussion by talking about Emmanuel Macron's education, his past, where he comes from. And Jeremy sits him squarely within the context of the French technocratic elite that has governed France for decades.
Well, first of all, I would actually quibble about calling him as an intellectual. I don't think he's an intellectual. He just happens to be a very well-educated, very clever man, who, although he's obviously born in the provinces and I think still lives in Le Touquet, I think, had, you know, as good an education as the French state could provide. And the French state self-consciously seeks to produce an elite, and he's part of that elite. So he's phenomenally well-educated, he's phenomenally clever, as well, he speaks perfect English. So he's part of that. Basically, the background, I suppose, is a sort of technocratic elite, which has traditionally run the French state. We know when he was sort of approaching power, there was a lot of discussion about this and where has he come from. And much was made of the fact that he had at some point been very close to a philosopher well known in France but not known at all here, a man called Paul Ricoeur, who was a very distinguished Catholic philosopher. But upon closer inspection, it turned out that, yes, they'd known each other, but there was no great sort of intellectual affinity and so on. So I don't think there's much, you know, there's a, it's essentially a very, very clever man who's had a very, very clever, who's had a very, very good education. And it's essentially a technocratic education. But one criticism he knows he's got to work hard for it not to stick is precisely that he's a member of that sort of elite. Mm. And so, for example, you know, the this meeting which he's had this week with 140 heads of multinational companies, which is a brilliant idea on his part, and that of course means he's you know he's back amongst his own people, so to speak. Mm. So what's he going to do? He's going to go to Switzerland. He's going to come out from Switzerland. And what's he then going to do? He's going to go up to the northeast of France, to a car factory, and then he's going to go right into the middle of France, to meet lots of farmers and so on. So he's very conscious that, you know, this is a criticism that could be made of him, that he's just part of that elite. So he goes out of his way because he really does believe in the importance of image. I mean, he's a very Blairite in that regard. He thinks image is really important. And, yeah. That, you know, we don't make political decisions, we don't make economic decisions for completely rational reasons. Image is really important. One of his jobs is to create the right image. So he's very, very conscious of that. What is interesting, one thing I was thinking about this the other day when someone said to me, you know, well, what he's done in France would be inconceivable in Britain, and that's true. But it isn't inconceivable in France because, of course, it's exactly what General de Gaulle did. If you think, when he said, well, this is remarkable that he's done this, well, actually, the French do this. What he's done, and General de Gaulle completely redrew the French political map, he completely redrew the French constitution and so on. I'm not saying that Macron would go that far. But there's a sort of tradition, it's that sort of Gaullist tradition of the sort of man of destiny who comes into play at a moment of crisis. And this, in the case of de Gaulle, it was obviously the Algeria crisis, but in this case it's been the sort of 30-year slowly evolving crisis about unemployment and so on and so forth. And there he was, the right man at the right time, at that moment when enough people in France suddenly thought, this can't go on. Mm. You know, something has got to change. And that's what he's been able to capitalise on. So it's quite an astonishing achievement.
So Macron is a part of the technocratic elite that have ruled France for some time. But he's also different. He worked at Rothschilds for many years. He worked in Anglo-Saxon finance. He's both an insider and an outsider. And consequently, he also seems intent on dismantling the very social settlement that de Gaulle himself created.
For a long, long time, there was this remarkable resistance to any change at all to something like legislation concerning redundancy payments and things like that. It was absolutely impossible. France would come to a standstill when anything like that was proposed. I mean, having lived in France for relatively long periods, I mean, I can remember, you know, massive demonstrations almost outside my front window for about changing an absolute, you know, tiny change in labour law.
Yeah.
Really, for the first time in a long, long while, probably since General de Gaulle, there is now a majority feeling in the French population that change is necessary. And I think one of the most remarkable things is there's actually been relatively little opposition. And at the time of his election, there was all this talk, you know, the trade unions would take to the streets and all of this sort of stuff. In fact, that's hardly happened. It's hardly happened. And I think that's partly because there's a recognition of where, you know, the power now lies, and that whereas before, I mean, the remarkable thing before was, you know, the French would sort of hide behind the railway workers. The railway workers were the great ones, like the miners in Britain. They were the ones who'd go on strike, and people would say, "Oh, it's a terrible thing." But of course, the railway workers are defending the rights which we could all lose if the railway workers are defeated. That hasn't happened, and I think because now there really is a genuine feeling in France that you know, something has got to change. And he's dealing with lots of things. I mean, one of the big issues at the moment he's dealing with, I mean, it's just something which shows you just how far France is behind other countries, is they've actually introduced this month, in fact, I think virtually this week, a new system for determining university entry. So the French have, for the first time, have introduced something like the UCAS system in this country, which we've had for about 40, 50 years. I mean, it was there when I was applying for university, and that's over 50 years ago. And even then, with this new system, there's one word you can't use, which is selection, because sort of the French don't like this. I don't know, you can't possibly, you know, at the moment it's essentially a lottery. It's quite genuine, it's a lottery. If there are not enough places for the applicants, then literally names are taken out of a hat. And it's having to reform things like that. So there are these, or virtually every aspect of French life has been sort of crying out for change for decades, and there's been no change. And I think what the vision is that if France is going to prosper or etc., then there simply has to be change, all, you know, right across the board. And that's what he's doing. And I don't think he imagines he's going to do it in one fell swoop. But I think he thinks that, and presumably is hoping that he'll be elected for a second time, and so on. That's the message inside. The message which he's conveying outside is the one which is, you know, the theme of this gathering in Versailles: choose France. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're making your decisions about where to invest, come to France. As France traditionally, well, again, over the last few decades, has not done well in internal investment, for example, external investment. So that's where he thinks image is really important. In the same way, you remember Tony Blair sold Cool Britannia.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same sort of idea. Here's a young guy. He's a good-looking guy. He's very intelligent. He's forceful. All of those sorts of things, and he perhaps naively believes that almost like he on his own can. And it's happened. I mean, if I can give you a little story, we here at King's have a lot of dealings with. This place, the Fondation Nationale des Sciences Politiques, Sciences Po, we're known, sort of equivalent to the LSE. And we were over there just before Christmas, and we were with their director. And he said, you know, it's quite remarkable. He said, we go all around the world, you know, meeting, go to Singapore, wherever it might be. And he said, we've got used to arriving in somewhere like Singapore or Hong Kong and being greeted with a sort of look on people's faces, oh, the poor French.
Mm.
Oh, they must have such a terribly hard time. Now, he says, since Macron's been elected, they go back to the same places and meet exactly the same people, and everyone says, oh, the lucky French, aren't you marvellous? Or you must be so, so pleased. That's important.
Yeah.
It's very important.
Yeah.
They're no longer seen as the sort of this, you know, they're, France is a sick man of Europe. Well, he's managed to get rid of that. And you look now, Spain's falling apart, Britain's in a terrible state, Germany can't bring into existence a government, and so on. So Mrs. Merkel looks on, sort of certainly weaker than she was. And what's Italy? If I forget Italy, Greece, etc. Here's France is, you know, the play is to get people to think, yet once again, that France is the leading country in Europe.
And Macron has luck on his side. There seems to be a vacuum at the heart of the West at the moment, a kind of nihilism about Western society. America has become a gigantic entertainment circus, is fulfilling just about every crass stereotype about American power, that it's shallow, materialistic. Britain is in a long decline, a long sort of series of acts of self-harm. So there really is an opportunity for Macron and France to reshape world affairs, to provide a distinctive European voice on the world stage. And I think Macron's doing this in really interesting ways. He gave a speech last year to the UN where he talked about the ideals of the French Revolution, the ideals of liberté, égalité, fraternité, and he said a couple of really interesting things. He said, these things are particular. These things come from the French genius, could only have come from the French national unit. And then he went on to say, but these are things that everyone can have access to. There are things like human rights, freedom of speech, freedom to organise politically. These are all French creations, and they're yours. So he creates France as a particular genius and a universal hope. So again, he's drawing on a kind of Gaullist vision that there is a French genius, there's a certain idea of France, and everyone can buy into it. Jeremy goes on to explain the contradictions in this vision, the tensions, and the historical complications that Macron risks running into.
Certainly since the French Revolution, if not before, if not a long while before, the French have always had that tendency, like America incidentally, to conflate their history with the universal. You know, what's good for France is good for the world. The values we have in France are indeed world values, etc. So the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And, you know, that's a tradition which was built during the end of the 19th in into the 20th century and so on. His position is a sort of standard republican position of the French, unlike Britain and the British, never endorsed the idea of France as a multicultural society. That's simply the way we had that big multicultural phase in Britain, where even the Queen, famously, I remember one of her broadcasts, or a Christmas broadcast, referred to Britain as a multicultural country. You would have no politician in France of any substance ever using that language. They do not see France as a multicultural society. And it goes back to things like the separation of church and state, which is effectively saying, listen, there's the world of the public world is in a sense a universal world. And those identity issues you're referring to are the bits you leave at home. Mm. Yes, you can be whatever religion you want to be, but that's a purely private thing. This is why they've had all the trouble over the veil and so on. This is all feeds into all of this. Yeah. I mean, we in Britain, I think, would still find it bizarre that we should say, you know, that someone could not wear, you know, a headscarf in the school. We might have slightly hardened our attitudes since 9/11 and so on, but I don't think anyone would say we need legislation to stop that. But in France, remember, they have legislation. And it's deeply, deeply controversial. Mm. But, you know, the roots are deep in French history. In the 19th century, up to the middle of the 19th century, approximately half the people who had actually lived in the geographical territory of France did not speak French. That is to say that French national identity had to be built, and it was a state project. And part of it was that language of universalism. And one of the ways in which it sold, traditionally sold, and this is the way it was sold in the empire, was actually that to be French was indeed to be not only a member of the greatest nation in the world, but be a part of civilization. France was civilization. There was no embarrassment about trying to eradicate minority cultures, because minority cultures, not just in the empire, but in France, take, for example, Brittany, were backward-looking. So, in a way, it was a process. To use that language of universalism was part of a process which is seen as being emancipatory. We're freeing people from darkness. So, for example, the use of Breton was simply banned in all French schools in Britain. Banned. The Breton language was only kept alive by the Catholic Church. It's in Catholic schools that did use Breton. French schools, no. All those minority languages are banned. The famous, I think it's the European Convention on Minority Languages or something like that, I can't remember what it's called. The French refused to sign. They would not sign that. Because they see these sort of minority, say these minority cultures, religion, whatever, it's backward looking, etc. So again, he's just doing. There's nothing new about this. This is standard orthodox stuff.
Yeah.
It's just that in recent years, in the wake of 9/11 and so on, there have been increasing calls for the French to rethink their policy towards religious minorities, in particular Muslims, etc., where they have a very significant Muslim population. But the basic line remains the same, and that will not change. That separation of church and state, the famous legislation, 1905, is one of the absolute bedrocks of French politics.
So part of Macron's foreign policy conceals an intolerant streak, which is a product of the French national mythology, a self-conscious creation of the 19th century and its peculiar intolerance of minority cultures in the French landmass. Jeremy goes on to talk about the destruction of Breton culture.
Brittany was traditionally very Catholic, and Brittany didn't side with the French Revolution. What did the revolution do? Mm. It famously sent in its army and effectively tried to wipe the population out. Mm. I mean, there's still immense controversy about it. I mean, the French army went into Nantes, for example, you know, which is a port just in the south of Brittany there. And they decided, well, we need an enormous number of people to kill. So how are we going to do it? Mm-hmm. And so it won't take too long to guillotine them and so on. So they got barges, filled it with Breton, took the barges out of the middle of the river, Loire, mm-hmm. and then pulled the plug and just let them sink. And that sort of goes back, say, certainly to the revolutions, that sense in which the Bretons were badly treated. Very interestingly, when the invasion of France by Germany took place in 1940, the Germans, being always very clever, used that nationalist sentiment in Brittany to get the Breton to actually side with them, and there was a lot of evidence of collaboration between Breton and the Germans. But the unifying factor being they wanted to defeat Paris, and so on. So that's one of the most significant areas. But if you think, the south, Languedoc, and all around there, these people did not speak French, and they were taught to be French. There were various instruments which were used to do that. You have the general process of modernization, improvement of communications, and things like that. Okay, the other two big instruments were actually the army, where France had a conscript army, and often for long periods you were conscripted for 3 years. So you take the young Breton, the young Provençal or whatever, who couldn't speak French and was uneducated and so on, put them in the army for 3 years, and they come out of Frenchmen, and they've seen the world and things like that. Well, universal conscription is gone. Again, only relatively recently, about 10, 15 years ago, conscription went. Again, great controversy about that, because people saw its importance to, as part of the sort of way you forge a French identity. Second one was education. The next one was education, the school. Mm. One of the great heroes, probably the great hero of, well, no, the, yeah, one of the great heroes of the of republicanism in France is the school teacher, especially the village school teacher, the person who goes into darkness and brings light. The army's gone, and French schools are basically in crisis. And again, this is a really big debate that's been running for years. You know, the recognition that the French school no longer performs that civic function. The school wasn't just to educate you in maths and physics and things like that. The school was there to make you into a good French citizen, to absorb those values and so on and so forth. For a whole variety of reasons, that is no longer operating. So the instruments which were used to forge that sense of French self-worth, French identity, and so on, are no longer really in place. The other one, of course, is the other big damaging thing has been mass unemployment in France now for two, three decades. It's very, very difficult to feel a part of something if you're out of work for a long period of time, etc. So there's that. Beyond that, of course, there's been, therefore, that general, France always likes to see its destiny as part of a universal destiny. That gets increasingly difficult to sustain if your power is steadily ebbing away. And what's been happening is French power has been steadily ebbing away. And with that there's a sort of general lack of loss of prestige and French culture and so on. And I think now, for example, even 20, 30 years ago, if you'd have probably almost like spoke to anyone in the street and say, name me a French philosopher, they'd have said, oh, well, there's Jean-Paul Sartre, there's Foucault, and all these sort of people. Who is there now?
Yes, indeed. The country of Descartes, Rousseau, Derrida, and Foucault now has Bernard-Henri Lévy or Michel Houellebecq, mere pygmies in comparison. So Jeremy emphasises the fragility of the Republican vision, its self-conscious creation in the 19th century, and the variety of contradictions it throws up in the present. Jeremy finishes by reflecting on the Front National.
I've always taken the view, the Front National has been around for a long, long time now, I remember. When it emerged, it was, everyone said it's a flash in the pan, it'll go, but it's been, 30 years or whatever. I've always taken the view, which is slightly controversial view, that in actual fact, the Front National is not opposed to that universalistic republican culture, it's parasitic upon it. Oh. It's simply a version of the same rhetoric. Where it's different is it's less accommodating towards Muslims and the standard republican stuff. But I think it basically, it's got its Catholic elements and so on, but I think the basic thrust is of a unified France, which basically doesn't want these people come in precisely because they're not going to accept the values of the Republic. I don't see it as a sort of necessarily anti-republican. I just think it just uses that language in a different way.
So we come back to de Gaulle's question: is France one, or two, or many? France has always been constituted by its divisions, but its leaders have always wanted to make it whole. In the UK, we have massive divisions between the Shire and the Metropole, between the North and the South. But every great leader we've had, every great figure, has offered a vision to the British that has unified us, has given us a better story. And I just wish in the UK that we had someone like Macron who was ready to articulate it. I hope you agree that was a fascinating discussion. And that was Jeremy Jennings, Professor of Political Theory at King's College London, and me, Alistair Benn. I do hope you listen in next week. We've got plenty more interview features, discussion, stuff from the team itself. We've got so much new material coming out, and we hope you listen in again.